J-E. Start, it's 8:06. Is that okay? We're going to go live in a minute. Benjamin is going to help us do that. I want to make sure everyone else is here.
Live, Rabbi.
We are live already?
We are live.
Wow, on Facebook.
Thank you, Benjamin.
Thank you, Benjamin. You're amazing. Okay, I just want to make sure we get as many of our fellows here because this is a really important class and series that we're about to begin. Okay, can you guys hear me, our live audience? I feel like, you know, the, what do you call them? You know, the talk shows, they've got like a couple of people in the audience live, and then the rest of them are like watching TV from afar. So that's what we got going on here. I want to start by wishing Nathaniel and Carly a mazel tov on their recent wedding. They're in Florida enjoying a little marital bliss.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Rizochah to build a bayit ne'eman b'Yisrael, a beautiful Jewish home in the land and the people with the people of Israel. Mazel tov, guys.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And Diane is with us. Tamar, Devra, Romy. And hello, welcome. How are you? You know what? If we can, Zahava, are you on with us, Zahava?
Yeah, I am.
Okay, if you can just bring out another like two packets, that would be great. Yes,
on the way.
Okay, excellent. All right. So we're going to begin. Rabbi Ezra, Rabbi Pinney, excuse me. So when you do it, just put it a little lower when you do your video. Yeah, you're going to be great. Okay. We're good?
We're good.
I want to just begin by thanking an old but very good friend.
I'm not that old.
Gary Wallen, who is putting up the MGE poster. My head's going to be blocking that, just so you know.
Look at that. Just do it off to the side a little.
We're trying to do a little identifying who we are a little. Hello, Brooke. Welcome, Brooke. Nice to have you.
Nice to be here. Hello, Rabbi.
And Andrew. Hello, Andrew. Hello. Is it Romy or Rami? I don't know. Okay. We are beginning our fellowship first kickoff class. And those of you who are not fellows, this is the one part of the fellowship program that's actually open to those who may not be fellows. We're going to get you a packet very, very soon. Nice to see you.
I'm coming.
What's that?
I'm coming.
Okay, very good. While we're wishing mazel tovs, we had one half. We want to wish a mazel tov? Wait, hold on. Oh, come. Jonathan, how are you? Welcome. I'm sorry. Give me one second, guys. Don't go anywhere. Amy, welcome.
Yeah.
Hello, Ari. We're getting started.
Maybe tomorrow.
Okay, I apologize. Now we're ready. Okay, we're all here. I want to wish a mazel tov to Kaylee, who's here. We had Serge here last week. He's on the way. Okay, awesome. I just want to wish you guys and bless you to be able to build a bayit ne'eman b'Yisrael, a beautiful and trusty, worthy home within the nation of Israel. Mazel tov, guys. A lot of weddings going on. I also want to wish a mazel tov to Rob Brody. Guys on the Rabbi Pinney side, Rob Brody got engaged. Just want to wish him a mazel tov. Yeah. We're having a kiddush for him this Shabbat. So a lot of great engagements and marriages coming up and happening. So really amazing. I just want everyone to know I'm not wearing my mask here, okay, because how far away am I from the actual live people? 20 feet? Really? I'm at least 10 feet. It's pretty solid, okay? Nice glasses. welcome, Harlan. So I just want everyone out there to know that's why I feel comfortable not wearing the mask. Can you guys hear me okay? I'm going to speak at this level. If you can't, just let me know. And I want to begin a new series tonight that is so fundamental, and it's the reason I'm starting the fellowship year off with this series, is because I believe it's the building block. It's the actual first stepping stone to everything we're going to be studying for the rest of the year. I don't want to put too much pressure on this one class, but there's just so much that is riding on the question that I want to raise with you this evening. You know, anti-Semites throughout history have accused the Jewish people of a lot of things. We've been accused of being manipulative, of being controlling, cheap, even aggressive. But interestingly enough, the Jewish people have never been called foolish, dumb, or stupid. We've been called everything under the sun, but never been accused of being unwise or foolish. And then my question is, why is it therefore that so many sophisticated, intelligent, well-educated Jews continue to believe in Judaism? It seems so outdated. It seems so from another generation. Why would we observe these seemingly outdated and archaic traditions in our contemporary society? And I think there are two possible reasons. You guys having the same problem when you go to the big dinners and you don't know whether to look at the actual person or the video? Is that what's going on here? I'm just a little box. Oh, there's three of me? I've tripled? That's just weird, man. Oh, because Zahava and Binyamin. Oh, that's spooky. Okay, one's enough. I'm sorry you have to look at me so much. Look over here, there's only one of me. So the question is, why would we observe these seemingly outdated and archaic traditions today? And I think there are two possible reasons. What's one reason? Tradition, the fiddler on the roof. Does anyone here really feel compelled to observe Shabbat, to give money to Jewish causes, to one day maybe send your kids to Jewish day school, which costs more money, to make important life and death decisions because of tradition? It's just like nostalgia. I'm challenging it a little. Maybe it's because keeping mitzvot and observing a Jewish way of life adds a certain meaning and purpose to our lives, right? And I think that's the approach we usually take at MGE. We try to show how keeping the Torah can make you happier, can help you navigate the difficulty and complexity of your relationships, how observing Shabbat gives you that perspective on life, how it permits us to be involved in the community, how keeping kosher gives us some discipline, not speaking ill of others is being a more sensitive person, right? We could give you a little reason behind all these different things. But there's another reason that's perhaps even more fundamental that we don't talk about much, and that the fellowship is very much based on. And that is because we actually believe that this is what God wants from us. Now, how do you really know what God wants from you? It has to start with what the Torah itself, because that's where we're getting all this information. We're still sitting under the sukkah. It's, you know, hopefully they'll never take it down until we get a vaccine. But why do we sit in a sukkah? We go out of the comfort of our homes and we sit in this little ratty hut. Sweet, it's nice. But why do we do it? I mean, maybe we can come up with some nice reasons, but most Jews do it because it's in the Torah. The Torah says so. And God wants us to do that. God wants us to observe Shabbat. He wants us to keep kosher. He wants us to refrain from speaking ill of each other. But how do we know that these are the things that God wants from us? How do we know that those things called mitzvot that we still see Jews observing to this day really come from God? And that's the fundamental question we have for tonight. We're going to actually try to answer it. How do we know that the Torah comes from a higher place, wasn't just written by a bunch of people? And to answer this question, I want to refer you to the handout that you have on your sheets. It's a little packet, but we're just going to do the first page. Literally page one. It says on the top, who wrote the Torah? You got it, guys, on the Zoom? In the chat? I see Carly, thumbs up. Katie, your little one, is she going to She's following along?
Yeah, sure.
She's going to be responsible for everything. She's
screaming a little. She's
so excited. Look at this. I mentioned your name and she starts crying. I'm sorry. Okay. By the way, I want to welcome Erica. Can you hear me, Erica? Nice to have you again. Okay. Erica Bli Einhar is 91. She's been joining us since COVID started for classes. She just waved. Okay. Okay, you guys have this? No, you have it right there. It's in your left hand. Page one.
It's also in the chat.
Yes. Thank you. Okay, good. So who would like to read the first verse? From let's take someone from our live audience. A live audience. Kaylee, go for it. Read away. Right, not Deuteronomy. It says Exodus 14:31. Do you not have it? Hold on. Okay, sorry about that. How many of you guys in Zoom land have this sheet right here? It says on top, who wrote the Torah, Revelation at Sinai. You don't have it either. No? Amy, do you have it? Okay. All right, Zahava's going to put it on. I'm going to begin, okay? Because I don't want to lose any more time. So the first verse that you'll get in a few moments, Zahava will post it. She's going to bring out some hard copies for the people in person and then post it after. So the first verse reads, I'm just going to read it in English, and I'm going to ask you, just pay attention, tell me, what event is this talking about from the Torah? The Israelites saw the great power that God had unleashed against Egypt. The people were in awe of God. They believed in God and his servant Moses. I'll read it again. The Israelites saw the great power that God unleashed against Egypt. The people were in awe of God. They believed in God and his servant Moses. Who can tell me? It's in Exodus. What? Splitting of the Red Sea. Right. What's a fire tornado? I think that was the movie version, but it says in the Torah that after the Jewish people left Egypt, remember Pharaoh finally had enough of all these plagues. He lets the Jews go. And then finally he changes his mind and he sends his Egyptian legions after him. And what happens when they get on the cusps of the sea? The Egyptians are coming on one side. The sea is on the other. The Jews start to freak out. And what miracle happens? You guys just said it a minute ago. What miracle in Zoom land, guys?
The Red Sea part.
Okay, very good, Daphne. The splitting of the Red Sea. The splitting of the Red Sea takes place. And immediately after the splitting of the Red Sea, the Torah says that the Israelites saw the great power that God had unleashed against Egypt. And the people were in awe of God. They believed in God and they believed in his servant Moses. So what does it seem to have accomplished, the splitting of the Red Sea? What does it seem to have accomplished, guys? Showing of God's power, and it inspired what within the people?
Believer.
Faith, belief. They started believing. Very good, Katie. Now I want to read you another verse from the Torah, a couple of chapters later. Okay? A couple of chapters later, the Torah says the following. I will come to you in a thick cloud so that all the people will hear when I speak to you. They will then also believe in you forever. Say it again. I will come to you in a thick cloud. We used to have this game when I was in yeshiva day school. It was one of the tests. The teachers would ask, Mi Amar El Mi, who said to who? So ask yourself, who is speaking to who here? I will come to you in a thick cloud so all the people will hear when I speak to you. They will also then believe in you forever. God is speaking to Moses. Good. After the giving, after Sinai, well, what, you're close, but what tense did I just read it in? I will come to you in a thick cloud. Has it happened yet? It has not happened yet because it's in the future tense. God says to Moshe, I'm going to come to you in a thick cloud so that all the people will hear when I speak to you. When did God come to the Jewish people and speak to Moshe that everyone else heard? When God gave us the Torah at Sinai. Very good. And what does it say at the end? And you should be troubled by this next line. They will then also believe in you forever. What's the problem, guys?
Could that imply that Moses has a certain divinity as well?
Okay, so that's a very good point, Brooke. I don't want to deal with that right now. Just assume for a moment when it says to believe in Moshe, it's not that Moshe is a god, but to believe in Moshe as a servant of God, as a prophet of God. It's talking about God, though. But what's even more difficult about the verse? It says, then they will also believe in you forever. What did we just say a couple of chapters earlier about the splitting of the Red Sea? Thank you, Zahava. What did we say about the splitting of the Red Sea before? Now that you have the sheets in person, Zahava, you could post the sheet also. Thank you. The Israelites saw, remember, what did the splitting of the Red Sea accomplish, guys? What did we say it accomplished?
Made them believers.
Showing of God's power and it instilled a certain faith in God. So what's the problem? Well, don't give me answers. Let's get the question first. What's the problem? What's the question of the verse we just read? I'll read it to you again. Take a look at the second verse, guys. I will come to you in a thick cloud, so all the people will hear when I speak to you. They will all then also believe in you forever.
They supposedly already believed.
Thank you, Deborah. Didn't the Jewish people already believe in God after what event? After what? The splitting of the Red Sea. If they're ready, if the Torah says, and I'll read it, I'll tell you in Hebrew and in English, Vayaminu b'Hashemu b'Moshe avdo. And God, and they believed in God and his servant Moses. And everyone agrees that the splitting of the Red Sea took place before the giving of the Torah. So how come when God tells Moshe, I'm about to give the Torah to the Jewish people, and I'm going to gather everyone around this mountain, and then they will believe? What do you mean, then they will believe? Don't they believe already? You hear the question? This is not my question.
It's a question... Were there things
that
happened in between to make them lose their belief?
Okay, now you're starting to give... I just want to make sure everyone gets the question, Katie, before you start suggesting an answer. Everyone understand the question. Why does the Torah say that God tells Moshe before the giving of the Torah, right before, after the splitting of the Red Sea, then that event is going to inspire faith? Shouldn't have faith already. The Torah says they had faith already from what event? From the splitting of the Red Sea. Okay, that's the question. So, Katie, you were suggesting something?
Yeah, I was saying that maybe something happened between the splitting of the Red Sea and getting the Torah that, like, made them question their belief.
Anybody know how long? It's an interesting suggestion. How long transpired between the splitting of the Red Sea and the giving of the Torah? And you could figure out the answer by determining how long there is every year between Passover and Shavuot.
49 days, 50 days.
Yeah, not a long time. What happened in that period of time that caused the Jewish people to sort of lose their faith? Or maybe they, or did they have faith originally? I don't know. Ask yourself. You're a slave. Your father was a slave. Your grandfathers were slaves. And Moshe comes along, performs all these miracles. Now you're convinced there's a God. He brings the Egyptian Pharaoh to his knees. 10 plagues. You're taken out in all of this fanfare and these miracles. Splitting of the Red Sea. Are you believing? The Nile turned... What's that? Okay, Serge says that they actually, 3 days after getting into the wilderness, they started complaining about not having enough water. They won what?
A war.
They won a war, that's true. They won a war that they didn't seem to be ready for. These were slaves, they weren't warriors, it's true. So I want to share with you an approach. You're all starting to dance around it a little. But what's going on, and you'll see what it has to do with us. Take a look on the handout. Does everyone have the handout yet in Zoom land? The front page here? Zahava should have posted it in the chat. I don't know if she did or not.
It's coming. Give me 1 second. I just want to make sure.
Okay, that's fine. I'm just going to start reading. Just follow me. You guys are all following me?
It's in the chat.
Okay. It's in there now?
Yes.
Okay, good. Guys, check the chat for page one. Okay, let's get a volunteer from Zoom. Because the people in person can hear the Zoom. But the Zoomers can't hear the people in person except for me. You understand that? That's what we're dealing with here. Okay, go for it. Can we get a Zoomer? Let's take our Carla. Carly, can you read it?
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out how to rotate it because it's sideways. the Israelites, that part?
Yeah, that part. No. Go where it says the Jews did not believe.
The Jews did not believe in Moshe, our teacher, because of the wonders that he performed. Whenever anyone's belief is based on wonders, he has misgivings because it is possible to perform a wonder through magic or sorcery. All the wonders performed by Moshe in this desert were not intended to serve as proof of the legitimacy of his prophecy, but rather were performed for a purpose. It was necessary to drown the Egyptians, so he split the sea and sank them in it. We needed food, and he provided us with manna. We were thirsty, so he split the rock, providing us with water. Korach's band mutinied.
I'm so sorry, you're going to have like a bad neck when you're finished reading.
So the earth swallowed them up. The same applies to the other wonders.
Okay, let's stop you right here. Now, Carly has been reading from Maimonides. Everyone here knows who the Rambam was. Maimonides lived in Spain and then Egypt, lived in the 1100s, was an awesome, awesome Jewish philosopher. And he codified all of Jewish law. And he said what Carly just read, that the reason that the Jewish people believed in whatever they believed in was not because of any of the miracles that took place. That's why I asked you by show of hands, how many of you guys would be inspired to believe in God if you saw a miracle, a supernatural event? And the Rambam is not satisfied that we should believe in God or in his Torah because of a miracle. What's wrong with believing in God or his Torah because of a miracle? What's so bad? Because when anyone's belief, he says, is based on a wonder, he has a certain misgivings. Now, he entertains the notion that perhaps the wonder took place through magic or sorcery. And I'll ask you, living in modern times, if you saw something supernatural, where would your mind go? How would you sort of try to rationalize the event? In the days of Maimonides, it was magic. It was sorcery. What about today? What would you think? A cosmic force. What about a computer-generated illusion? Science. right? An optical illusion. Like, I mean, how many movies have we all been to where like a lot of that stuff was literally not even produced in a studio? It was just literally on a computer screen, and it looks real. I remember going to a Universal Studios when I was a kid and seeing all of these like cool movies that they showed, and like the big rock that was following Indiana Jones and Raiders of the Lost Ark. If anybody's seen that movie, I'm dating myself, but I love that movie. And there was this like huge boulder, and I saw the boulder, and it was like it looked like a piece of sponge cake, you know, it was nothing. And all of these optical illusions. So substitute computer graphics, substitute something that you might think is producing some awesome event. And that's why the Rambam says miracles are never a good source for belief. So why are there so many miracles in the Bible? Clearly, there are a lot of miracles in the Torah. What were they there for? So the Rambam says, Carly just read the second paragraph, that all the wonders performed by Moses in the desert were not intended to serve as proof, but rather they were just done for a reason. It was necessary to drown the Egyptians. Why was it necessary, guys, to drown the Egyptians? Because they were trying to kill us, okay? So God split the sea and drowned them. We needed food, right? There are no 7-Elevens in the desert, okay? They needed water. They needed something to drink, something. So God performed a miracle and gave them something to, but he didn't do that to inspire faith. Because if you start developing faith, suggests Maimonides, from miracles, you're always going to have a little question. You're always going to wonder, and you're always going to doubt and be filled with skepticism. The only question is, what now is the source for the Jewish people's faith? If it ain't miracles, then what was it? What do you think? If it wasn't miracles, then what was it? It's a little of a trick question, because you're probably thinking of the revelation at Sinai as a miracle. But we don't look at it as a miracle. Look at the next line. Carly, can you continue to read for us? What is the source of our belief in him?
Sure. I just need to find
that. X off that.
Okay. What is the source of our belief in him? The revelation at Mount Sinai, our eyes saw and
that's
not...
That's it. The revelation at Sinai, that's the source. Keep reading now.
At Mount Sinai, our eyes saw and not a stranger's, our ears heard and not another's. There was fire, thunder, and lightning. He entered the thick clouds. The voice spoke to him, and we heard, Moshe, Moshe, go tell them the following. Thus Deuteronomy relates, face to face God spoke to you. And Deuteronomy states, God did not make this covenant or... this covenant, our fathers, but with us who are all here and alive today. Okay. How is this?
Okay, we could stop right there. Excellent. So okay. You want to just answer what was the source of the Jewish people's faith in God, according to Maimonides? It's not the splitting of the Red Sea. It's not the rock. I don't know if you guys remember this from your Bible stories, your bar bat mitzvahs, but there was a rock, and God told Moshe to speak to the rock. He hit the rock instead, but water came forth. Right, so that was miraculous. That was supernatural. But that is not the source of our faith in God. That should not be, because who knows how that happened exactly? Who knows, right? What is it then? So he answers that it's the revelation at Sinai. Now, what is the difference between witnessing all those miracles, the 10 plagues, the sea splitting, the manna falling from the heavens, and the giving of the Torah at Har Sinai? How come Maimonides does not consider the giving of the Torah at Har Sinai a miracle? What was it? How is it different than all the other events?
All of us. God was there. We saw God there.
Well, we were all there, right?
Okay. Okay. Katie and Carly. Wait, let's do that. Katie just said, because what? What did Katie say?
God was there. Like, didn't God give the first two commandments? So we like saw him.
Oh, so there was some sort of direct experience with God, as opposed to What about the splitting of the Red Sea? What are you thinking about when the splitting of the Red Sea is taking place? Say again. Well, you didn't really see God. You didn't really hear God. You just saw a sea splitting, and you see Moshe. It wasn't like Moshe did it. It just happened. God told Moshe to take his staff, and there's a medrash that says that one of the people jumped in the water, and when it got to his nose, it finally split. But you didn't hear God saying, watch what I'm doing, guys. You just saw something miraculous. The giving of the Torah was different. What was at the giving of the Torah? It was a direct communication from God. Carly, you said something else as well.
The second yeah, factor. We were all there.
Everyone was there.
Like every generation.
So that's something we're going to talk about in a moment, actually. And this is really the major way that Judaism has distinguished itself from all other major religions, in that all Jews at that point experienced the revelation themselves, as opposed to what other faith systems argue, which is what? Virtually every other, every other monotheistic faith system argues that one person had that revelation with God. And then how do they try to prove that experience, that they had that experience to other people? What do they always use? What did Jesus use? What does Muhammad use? What all the other prophets of the other great faiths use? Because no one else was there. It was just them. They use miracles. And Maimonides just told us that miracles can never be a source of faith, because who knows? There's always this question. There's always this doubt. There's always this skepticism. And by the way, if you turn the page on your handout to page 2 now, I want to share something with you. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but this has happened again and again throughout Jewish history. It was actually the first page of the packet originally. Take a look where it says Deuteronomy chapter 13. Let's get another. Diane, you want to read for us, Diane?
Yeah, I was going to offer, in fact. Okay, one second. I'm reopening.
Deuteronomy 13, verse 2 through 6.
I'm going to do, for people who are reading on Zoom, you can download it and then turn it upside down on your computer.
Yeah,
so I don't.
Or you can just go on your head, which is very good for the circulation. Go ahead.
You have the
Can everybody hear me?
Yes. Okay. Just please mute your computer if you're not speaking.
I'm not sure. He brought them back, but then just gave us page 1.
That's us in the office. Okay, go for it, Diane.
Does should be Moses
Moses' appointment.
Is that where you want me to start?
No, where it says Deuteronomy chapter 13, verse 2.
Okay. If there arise among you a prophet or a dreamer of dreams, and he gives you a sign or a wonder, and the sign or the wonder of which he spoke to you comes to pass, and he says, let us go after other gods which you have not known, and let us serve them. Do not listen to the words of that prophet or dreamer. God your Lord is testing you if you are truly able love the God your Lord with all your heart and all your soul.
Okay, excellent. So, what is he saying? This is called the Navi Sheker. This is actually referring to a situation where other prophets come along and try to disprove Moses' prophecy and try to claim that they are the true and the only real true prophet. There arise among you a prophet or dreamer of dreams, and he gives you a sign or a wonder. Why is this prophet giving you a sign? What's a sign or a wonder? A miracle. They're trying to prove to you that they're the real deal. Why are they doing that? Because you and I were not there. You see, Moshe never had to do that because we saw the same thing that Moshe saw. Every single man, woman, and child was at Sinai experiencing the revelation at Sinai. And therefore, the miracles were not necessary. Why were miracles done then, according to Maimonides? Simply to get things done, but not to inspire faith, because we didn't need it. But other prophets who came along, other prophets come along, and they experience this revelation alone. And therefore, what they're going to try to do is say what? Let us go after other gods which you have not known. Let us serve them. The Torah says, do not listen to the words of that prophet. God, your Lord, is testing you to see if you are truly able to love God, your Lord, with all your heart and with all your soul. This is very, very important. Because what's happening here is that Jewish tradition is teaching that every man, woman, and child experienced the revelation. Everyone there experienced the revelation, heard God reveal the Ten Commandments, and therefore all of those miracles that were being done or attempted to be done by other faith systems were not necessary for the Jew. Again, Zahava, I think you're on. Zahava? Let's see if I can mute myself. One of my pictures. No. Okay. All right. Now, I know what you're all thinking. This would be great if you were one of those people that was there. Now, Carly said something before. There is this tradition in Kabbalah that every soul, every Jewish soul, even an individual who was not Jewish, who later converted to Judaism, their soul also was at Sinai. Play for a minute. Because I don't know if you remember being there. If you have any consciousness of that event, anyone here remember being there? That's where the Kabbalah says that your soul was there. On a purely rational level, how do we understand this? All of this makes a lot of sense for those that perhaps heard this themselves. Every man, woman, and child was at Sinai, heard the Torah being given. But physically, at least, I don't remember it. And therefore, what basis is there for me in the year 2020 for me to believe that this event took place? It's nice that I believe that I have a basis to believe that every man, woman, and child who lived at the time was there. But what about me? I'm the one who's trying to be convinced here that the Torah is from God. And by the way, it really does matter. And I'll get back to that in a few minutes. To answer this question, you really have to ask yourself another question. Why do we believe certain events in history take place that we ourselves never experienced firsthand? And how many of you guys ever saw the Civil War? Now, if I ask for a show of hands, I would imagine that most of the people listening here believe the Civil War took place. Was anyone there? Anyone see it? Anybody know anybody that fought in the Civil War? Have you seen any physical documentation or proof that the Civil War actually was fought? Anybody been to a museum? Maybe, yeah, one or two people. Okay. Not everyone. I read about it in my social studies sixth grade textbook. My teacher seemed to know what she was talking about. A lot of other people believe it was true. So I bought it. I went along with it like everybody else. What happens if you're not experiencing an event and someone is telling you about that event? What do we need to believe that it actually took place? So it's secondhand information. Secondhand knowledge, we have to rely on secondhand knowledge because it's impossible for us to recreate the event if we ourselves were not there physically. I mean, take the Shoah, take the Holocaust. I always use this example. We have people even alive today who are survivors, thank God, they should live and be well. And there are other people still denying that the Holocaust ever took place. Now, what's going to happen in 100 years when there are no more survivors? I'm going to paint a crazy scenario for you. Imagine in 300 years from now, there's this terrible neo-Nazi group that rises to power and is somehow successful at destroying every Holocaust museum, memorial, physical documentation. There are no more survivors left. There is no remnant of anything physical to prove that that event took place. What is the basis then for you and I to believe that that event actually happened, that 6 million Jews' lives were taken at the hands of the Nazis? What do we have? I'm asking you guys, what do we have? What's that?
Word of mouth and talking about it through the generations being passed down.
Wait, Deborah, before, say again. What does that mean, collective memory? There's no one alive anymore, and there's no piece of paper, there's no museum. Yeah, okay, so that's what Deborah was just saying also. Information passed down from generation to generation, that's widespread. Deborah, what was the words that you just used a minute ago?
Transcending from generation to generation.
Transmitted from generation to generation.
Yeah.
And it helps that so many people believe it. Does that prove that it happened, by the way? Can you actually prove that it happened? You can't 100% prove that it happened, but you can make a very, very good case. Let me ask you a question. We've got some attorneys here, I'm sure. Just statistically, there has to be some lawyers here. What is the highest level of proof in this country? Beyond a reasonable doubt, in order to take another person's life or to incarcerate them for life, to give them life imprisonment, you have to prove for capital crime beyond a reasonable doubt. Why don't we make the prosecution prove it 100%? It's impossible. You know, it's impossible also in science and in math. Okay, now we maybe get closer in science and math, but certainly not possible in history. So we have different levels of proof, preponderance of evidence, beyond a reasonable doubt, that's the highest level, but there's no such thing as 100%. However, information that many or most people believe to be true, passed down from generation to generation, doesn't prove the event took place, but it becomes a very solid and rational basis to believe that that event took place. And it's the reason we believe so many things that we read about in our social studies books in sixth grade. Now, when it comes to secondhand knowledge, though, we only usually take that information seriously when many people believe it. And I'm not sure why this is, but we all know that the more people who attest to the fact, the more believable it becomes. I'll give you the example. I've given this example many times. What's your favorite train that you like taking, even during COVID? What's that?
Subway.
The L. Okay. So Alan is waiting for the L train. And you're waiting. And there are about, I don't know, let's say a dozen people in the train station with you. You don't know them. They're all wearing masks, 6 feet. Everything's cool. One of them walks over to you and says, "Didn't you hear the L train? It derailed. Everyone's okay, but it's not coming." And he leaves. There's 11 other dudes there waiting for the train. Alan, do you leave the train station? One person. Okay, that's fine. A show of hands. Zoom, in person. How many of you guys leaving the train station? One person came and he left. He walked out. I'm not saying he did. I'm just asking, I'm trying to make a point. Alan is a man of faith. He's going with the one guy, even though there are 11 other people still waiting for the train. Now, let's say three more people come over and tell you the same thing. Train derailed, it's not coming. And they all leave. Show of hands, anyone else leaving now? More people start leaving. 10 people come over to you, and they don't seem to know each other. Okay, you hear my point, okay? All right. Alan just said he would have been on the ferry already. Okay. So the question is, what changed from when the first person picked the wrong person? No one says yes on the first thing. I wanted you to hear no and then yes. It's just not convenient for me. You're a bad plan, Alan. So one thing that helps us believe secondhand information is that so many other people believe. Now, it doesn't prove it, because everybody could be lying or everybody could have been hallucinating the same thing at the same time. It's true, going back to Sinai, that everyone could have been on the same drug at the same time, having the same cool vision of this God coming out of nowhere and revealing the Ten Commandments. And then Moses writing it down, by the way, in 13 different Torah scrolls, passed those scrolls down from generation to generation. It's entirely possible that, I don't know, there was some cool weed out there in the wilderness. Everybody got a hold of it and they all started, you know, LSDing the same thing. That's one possibility. The other possibility, somebody lied. Somebody made it up. Somebody fabricated and got lots of people to go along with the lie. See, that's what you have to believe in order to deny that this event ever took place. You'd have to believe that either lots of people lied and passed down a lie from generation to generation, or everybody had the same hallucination. The likelihood of this entire event being fabricated is very low. Because the chance that millions of people got together and decided to make up this event and pass it on to their children. Compare that if Moses alone was the only one who received the Torah. If it was just Moshe and, let's say, his brother Aaron, and they're like, wow, that was an unbelievable experience. Aaron, we got to go prove it to the rest of the Jewish people. Let's do some miracles. But that's not what happened. The rest of the Jewish people saw exactly what Moses and what Aaron saw themselves. Again, it doesn't absolutely prove it, but we don't live our lives or make our most important decisions in life based on absolute truth because it doesn't exist. What we have to do is follow what makes the most amount of sense. And I really believe, I'm not saying this makes it easy to believe that the Torah is from God, but I think it gives us what Lawrence Kellerman in his book wrote, Permission to Believe. You ever hear that? It's a great book called Permission to Believe. That's all. We just need permission to believe. We don't need absolute proof. Now, something else that's important to keep in mind. It's not just the Jews who believe in this. You should just know both the Christian and Islamic religions are based on our revelation, which they never denied. Okay? They just believe that because we didn't accept Jesus as our savior or Muhammad as the true prophet, right? So we veered off, and therefore we're in an appropriate religion to continue to follow. But whether this event took place or not was never denied. And if they denied it, their faith systems would also crumble. Because Christianity and Islam were based on the Jewish people originally receiving the Torah at Sinai. Too many people believed it. Too many people think it's part of history. Now, I want to leave you, though, with what I think is even a more powerful argument. And I remember when I was 18 years old, I went to this program called Discovery by Esha Torah. Has anybody ever heard of the Discovery program? It used to be very, very popular. And it used to be 3 days. Now it's like down to a day because nobody has any patience anymore. But it was a 3-day program. I remember I went with my brother. And what they tried to do was show you parts of the Torah that seem very difficult to understand had they been written by people. Again, not trying to prove, because I don't think it's provable. I will tell you, as an attorney, this is not proof. But solid evidence to make a very reasonable case for the divinity of the Torah, to give us permission to believe. A couple of things they said I'll share with you. I'm just going to leave you with these tonight. Number one, honesty. And again, this is not proof. But you will never find a more self-critical and honest accounting of a nation's history than the Bible. And if, in fact, the Bible was written by people, like some people claim it was written by these scholars who lived centuries ago, no, none of the books of antiquity do the people who write about their own history, write about their own defeats and self-critique and talk about how much they complained and fetched for water and for food in the desert. The Bible is so honest. Now, again, if it was written by people or even the rabbis, it's hard to believe it would have been so critical, certainly from that period of time, when most books of antiquity were so always lauding and praising themselves. I'll get a little more specific. Aliyah L'Regel. What is Aliyah L'Regel? Three festivals. What are the three festivals in Judaism? We're sitting under one of them. Pesach, Sukkot, and Shavuot. Good. Why are they called Aliyah L'Regel? Anybody makes Aliyah? They go up. What's Regel? Regel are your feet. Because these are the three. Anybody know why they called the feet festivals? Shoshana, do you know? I can't see your facial expression, so I'm just going with your hands. So they're called Aliyah because you go up with your... You have to go to the temple. Those are the three times a year all Jews were commanded to go to the temple, bring the special offerings and sacrifices. If a human being or a leader was going to write a law, would it be so impractical to basically announce to the world that all the male army service age and up individuals will be leaving their homes, leaving the borders unprotected, and going up to Jerusalem to bring their special offerings in the temple? If the Torah was written by a human being, why would they make up such a foolish law when most ancient kings were concerned about being attacked. You're basically proclaiming to the world, you know, by the way, this actually happened in modernity. On Yom Kippur of 1973, the Egyptians and the Syrians came together and attacked Israel because they thought, they knew everybody was going to be in synagogue, we'll catch them off guard. It was a terrible war, and we lost 2,500 of our brothers and sisters, but it actually turned out a little better because it was easier to mobilize because everybody was in shul. And they were literally going into synagogues with names of people where they should go on that day. But this is an aside. Here's another one, Shemitah. Has anybody ever heard of Shemitah? The mitzvah to let the land. Anybody know in Zoom land what Shemitah is?
Every 7 years, you like don't basically grow crops or you don't sell it.
Right. You're not permitted to work the land in the land of Israel on the sabbatical year. It gets like its own Shabbos on the seventh year. Just listen to this for a moment. It is forbidden for a farmer in Israel to do anything on their land for that entire year. Think about that for a minute. What's the problem? What's that? How do you live? How do you survive in a completely agrarian society, which Israel was until maybe 60, 70 years ago? How would anyone survive if everyone had to leave their land lay fallow for the entire year? By the way, we're not the only ones to know that if you overwork your land, you will deplete the soil of its nutrients. So everyone did this in the world. Farmers all over the world would graft their lands, work this part while they let that part rest. And then when they hit this part, they let that part rest. But who in their crazy mind would demand that everyone in this one country let their land stay fallow for the whole year? How would they survive? Again, Esha Torah, this discovery problem, they were trying to throw that out as like another indication, like it must have been some supernatural creator that was going to somehow figure it out. Moral innovation is the fourth. And I know this is not going to sound so powerful, like big deal, because thank God we all grew up in the 21st century where these things are taken for granted. But do you realize the Torah was the one to bring ethics and morality into the world? Before the Bible, might made right. From Greece and Sparta up until Nietzsche, it's all about power. You study your history, it's all about who's got the power. The Chiddush, which means the insight of ethical monotheism of Judaism, is chesed, which means kindness, transmitted through the great Jewish prophets of Isaiah and Ezekiel. No human force ever existed which preached kindness. Now, it's a sad thing to say that it had to have come from God because no human being would have. But no human being did this. There were laws like the Hammurabi Code, which was an ancient code of law, but it didn't have any ethical mores. It was just a practical legal system to keep life civil in society. Up until 100 years ago, war was considered a good thing. In most countries, war boosted the national ego, right? It was good for the economy often. But back in the year 700 BCE, Isaiah the prophet was giving over God's word to beat their swords into plowshares, which is a phrase that's in engraved on the front building of the United Nations here in New York City. We were preaching peace before anybody was talking about peace. Where did that come from? Now, there's another crazy Gemara, which I'm going to end with this. Gemara is the Talmud. How do you know what's a kosher animal or not? Anybody know? Guys in Zoom land? What is the criteria for, right? So Howard is saying two, or you're saying peace, or two. What are the two criteria for kosher animals?
Split hooves.
Has to have split hooves and?
Chew its own cud.
And chew its own cud. Excellent. What if an animal had one but not the other?
No.
No good. He needs both. Does the Torah tell us a few examples of animals that have one but not the other? It gives four examples. A pig. What's that? A camel. Very good. Camel does what? A camel chews its cud, but doesn't have a split hoof. Good. Okay, it's not a rabbit, it's a hare, H-A-R-E. It looks like a rabbit, very good. And then there's the hyrax. I actually saw hyrax in Israel, H-Y-R-A-X, very cute. Those are the four animals that the Torah says don't get confused by them because they've got one sign but not the other. You need both. It's very interesting because medical science to this day. Are there any other animals? Are there any other animals that have split hooves, that have one or not the other? Because they're listed in the Torah. And if the Torah was written by people, who knew back then that these are the only four animals that have either split hooves or chew their cud? Now you say, let's say Moses wrote the Bible. Does that mean whoever wrote the Torah had to have somehow traveled the world, most of which was undiscovered at the time, to know that these would be? Now, I want to be intellectually honest with you. I've been giving this lecture for many years, but a few years ago, a great rabbi named Natan Slifkin came out with a book called The Fifth Animal. It killed this whole theory because there was a fifth animal actually that they discovered. But he has an entire book. I'm in the middle of reading it, and I'll get back to you. And he still thinks it can be used as some kind of evidence. Because four out of five is not bad in, you know, 3,300 years. But still, how would they have really known? I forgot what it is. They have it. It's in the book. I'm so sorry. I have the book at home. I've been reading it. I read it this past summer, and I got bored after a while. It was, like, so technical. By the way, the Torah says that the Talmud, the oral tradition, says that this is like evidence, if you will, that the Torah is from Sinai, the Torah is from God. Despite all the signs, no one's come up with this fifth animal. And here we've got the fifth. But besides all of this, just something about the profundity and the wisdom of the Torah bespeaks a divine author. There's just too much depth. There's just too much insight into the human condition and into the world around us for this document to have been created by people. I mean, and we believe, by the way, in great scholars. And I've had the opportunity in my life to be mentored by awesome scholars who are brilliant. But we simply could not have known ourselves that well. And not to, God forbid, put any human scholar down. But as awesome as the writings of William Shakespeare, or the philosophy of Kant, or Plato, the music of Beethoven, or the science of Einstein, their extraordinary contributions and their brilliance are dwarfed by the wisdom and by the influence of the Torah. Because the more you study it, the more insight into the human condition it reveals. The more we plumb its depths, the more miraculous, the more it manifests, I should say, its true author. And I think ultimately that's really the proof, if you will. The best proof is that the more you study it, there's a beautiful line in the ethics of our fathers, hafochba, which means if you turn it upside down, shake it up, more wisdom just keeps coming out. I mean, is there any other book in the world that people can study the same thing again and again? Every year we go through the same portions. It's the same stories. How is it that it continues to inspire? Alan, you want to do me a huge favor? You just tell Zahava to put her computer on mute. She's sitting like right over there. Do you mind? Buffalo was the fifth?
I don't know. I hope they
were you Googling? All right, Alan thinks it's a buffalo. But anyway, I it's possible, and I don't know if you've ever had a book that you've read, you keep coming back to, and you find a deeper layer. You know, that's possible with humanly authored work. There are such books, of course. But somehow the Torah, the wisdom, and the ability to really transform ourselves through its study is just something that bespeaks God. It's something that bespeaks something greater. And I think, honestly, the best indication of the divinity of the Torah, welcome Rabbi Avi, the best indication of the divinity of the Torah is the Torah itself. It sells itself because of its transformative powers and its transformative nature. What I want to do with you guys in subsequent weeks is, now that we've establish, and I'd love to hear any questions or comments. Let's start with the people in Zoom. Any questions or comments? I've been lecturing the whole time. Any, look at this. Katie's little girl is completely out. She's just done. Oh.
I wish.
You wish, right? Any comments or questions? Hey, Ben, how are you? Yeah, Brooke, please.
Just what do you say just about the actual kind of like history of the physical text itself? And do you have any insight on that? Because these things that you're saying are beautiful, but, you know, to the kind of immutability of the Torah as relayed on Sinai through all the different kind of parchments on different scrolls and things like that, they get destroyed in time and what the actual text says. Yeah. How do we believe in that?
So that's a great, is everyone hearing what Brooke is, it's a really good question. So by the way, anybody know who the oldest Torah scroll is? The Aleppo Codex, which was discovered somewhat recently, and it is about 1,000 years old, and they actually analyzed it and determined they found about 200 variants between the Aleppo Codex, which was found in Aleppo, Syria, and the Torahs that we use today. Not one of those discrepancies between the Torah there and the ones we have today have any substantive difference whatsoever. It's extraordinary. Now, it's not foolproof. It's not foolproof. We're still human beings. But there are about 7 or 8 things that we do, traditions that we have when we write a Torah to make sure that it resembles exactly the other Torah scrolls. So we believe, according to tradition, we're going to study this next week, that Moses, before he died, wrote 13 Torah scrolls. He gave one to each tribe, and he put one by the side of the Ark of the Covenant. When a scribe writes a Torah, he has to spend years mastering all of the specifics of how to write a letter in the, it looks like beautiful calligraphy. Has anyone ever seen like a scribe actually writing a Torah? It's like literally a piece of art, but they're following a very, very specific instruction. And here's a little thing that we do every Shabbos. And I remember it traumatized me when I was a bar mitzvah boy. What happens if you make a mistake when you're reading from the Torah on Shabbos? Why does everyone have to yell out the correct way of pronouncing the word or the letter? It's so embarrassing. I remember as a kid, I was like freaking out the night before my bar mitzvah. Harlan is going to be reading this Shabbos, some part of the Parsha. Right? And we're going to yell at him. We're not going to yell at him, but we're going to yell out. We do all these crazy things to make sure we are preserving the authenticity of the biblical text. But I will be honest, Brooke, there are, and we're going to talk next week about the oral tradition. There definitely were times when there were breaks and there were mistakes, because there is a human component to this. And whenever there's humanity involved, there's going to be mistakes, obviously. But we've done actually a pretty good job at preserving the authenticity of the biblical text. And the Aleppo Codex, I think, is pretty good evidence. You guys can Google it if you want. There's really some fascinating information about the Aleppo Codex. But I don't want to take too much more time. But those are some specific examples of things that we do to preserve the transmission of the Torah itself. You're talking about the 5 books of Moses. Ooh. Well, who is it written by? I'm going to bother you during the week. Maybe I'll send, I want to send you guys like emails during the week, just like one, you know, like other follow-up articles and books that you can read on some of the discussions we're having. So maybe I'll include that. Any other questions? Because I want to, we're already a couple minutes over. Any other quick questions before we finish this very light topic tonight? That was facetious. Okay, Jacob. I didn't even know you were on with us, Jacob. Jacob Zarzecki. Is that how I pronounce your name?
Yeah, that's accurate.
Okay, good. Jacob, you okay? Were you able to follow all this?
Yeah.
Excellent. No, okay.
A lot of stuff, but...
It's a lot of stuff. By the way, feel free, please, during the course of the week, to email me, markwildes@gmail, markwildes@gmail, with any questions or comments. You want to schmooze on the phone for a few minutes, you didn't want to ask this question in front of the people, you forgot, whatever it is. I'm available. I love talking out this stuff during the week. Please don't think because you didn't get something during the class that we can't, we have to wait till next week. That's for everyone here. I mean that sincerely. Okay, I'm going to stop here, give you guys a few-minute break. You're in for a great treat. You've got Rabbi Avi tonight. We're kicking off the year on our strongest foot. Eat some sushi, drink some more stuff, hang out a little. I want to make a quick announcement for everyone here. This Friday night, we're having Friday night services right here on the roof at 6 p.m. So if you're in town, you'd like to join us, we'd love to have you. 6 p.m. right here on the roof, FNL. It'll go till about 7 and then some refreshments. And then we're having a dinner at Mike's Bistro. I think we have one or two spots if anybody still wants to come.
So not Mike's, Amsterdam Burger.
Oh, I'm sorry. What did I just say?
Mike's.
That's like a little dream, you know. Amsterdam Burger. The food is really good. It's just as good as Mike's Bistro. Sorry about that. A little Freudian slip, you know. Have you ever been to Mike's Bistro? It's really good. Really, really good. That's another organization. Sorry. Okay, that's and Shabbat morning, we're going to be in Central Park because the weather is supposed to be really nice. So we're going to be meeting at the Turtle Pond, which is like the tip end of Rabbi Avi. How do you describe where the Turtle Pond is? North of the Great Lawn in Central Park at 9:30. Sorry. South, not north. Forget the. Just ask the. When you see a turtle, just ask where their friends hang out in the pond, in the turtle pond. Okay, guys, thank you all for participating, and please stay with me on this mini series called "From Sinai to Manhattan." We just started up at Sinai. We're going to get closer to Manhattan over the next couple of weeks. We're going to take it now from the belief in the divinity of the Torah to now trying to understand. How do we get all the mitzvahs that we have today? Because thousands of years have transpired. And Brooke, we're going to be coming back to your question also about the authenticity of the transmission. It's actually going to be sort of fleshed out over the next few weeks as well. Have a great night, everyone. Stick around. Don't turn off your Zoom. We're going to leave it on for Rabbi Avi. And I'm going to go to the other side of the sukkah and teach the senior fellows.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you, everyone. It was awesome. And by the
Thank
way,
you, Rabbi.
By the way, I'm going to send out a homework question. Please do your homework, boys and girls. Please do your homework. It's just going to be like one or two questions to jog your memory so that, you know, by the time next week comes, this won't be like a faint, you know, memory. That's all. So try to do I'll either do it in an email or send it in the chat. I'll figure it out with Zahava. It'll probably be an email. Okay. Zahava, any other announcements before Rabbi Avi comes on?
Yes, Rabbi Avi's actually on a different Zoom, so I put the link in the chat, so just click the link and...
Oh, you sure he's not staying on the Zoom?
Yes, I'm sure I'm the one who sent out the link for the class.
Okay, fine.
So that link that you sent for Rabbi Avi's class looks like it's for...
Oh, God. Okay, sorry. Sorry, yeah. I did that again. Hold on one moment. Let me paste the right link. Don't go anywhere.
Should we just leave him on this?
No, because, yeah. I guess everyone's here who's going to be in Rabbi, who's going to be in.
Yeah, you know what, guys, stay on this. Stay on this.
Yeah, I'll
Are we going to time out on it?
No.
We won't time out?
No, but it's recording. You want to stop recording?
Yeah.
Okay, do you want to still go on Facebook?
What do I do? Oh, yeah, turn it off Facebook.
Okay. I got the recording.